Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello, welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Edgar's been getting wonderful guests for us to get to visit with lately, and we got a few minutes now with Desiree Cifuentes before we go back to getting Joe to answer questions. And I do apologize, especially to Susan in Idaho, who I think has been waiting a long time, but we'll probably just give her a pile of Joe's books and hope that that will make up for all the long waiting. But if you're online, you know that there's a cadre of really wonderful, among all the other things that are there online, there is this group of really wonderful young apologists and evangelists who are sharing the Catholic faith in all kinds of interesting ways that are very helpful to people where they are, not just people who already know where to look for this stuff, but they're going out and in a certain sense, on the highways and byways of the internet and finding people. Desiree makes the uncatechized Catholic, I don't know if my words are correct, podcast, but mostly I know it from Instagram. Desiree, thank you for being here with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Joe, and thanks for waiting so that I can talk, Susan.
Oh, did you want to talk to Susan? Oh, you're.
You're.
Yeah, I gotcha. So, are you? I'm right. You're mostly you do your work on Instagram.
I do. Yes, I am actually going to graduate from Franciscan University in 3 weeks, and then I will get to pivot into the podcast space. So you're not wrong. You're just ahead of your time right now.
Well, but I don't know if you know if they told this to you, but are you graduating with a degree in theology, or what are you graduating?
I am theology.
So if you graduate from Franciscan University with a degree in theology, you automatically have a job at Catholic Answers. They just all we got people all over here with that degree. So I think you automatically get to come here. So tell us what you do on the uncatechized Catholic. First of all, what does that mean, the uncatechized Catholic?
So uncatechized Catholic is what I used to be, and uncatechized Catholics are who I am speaking to.
Okay.
The super brief background of my life as I was raised Catholic, but I was not very well catechized. And so there was much of my adult life experience sort of trying to come to grips with my faith and to understand it and make heads or tails of it. After I had a profound reversion experience, I really wanted to understand the why of my faith, because my reversion was very emotionally charged. And I thought, my emotions are for me, but if I'm going to be able to convince anybody else of why this is correct, I ought to know why. And after trying to teach myself for years and years, I recognized that I was going to need to get a degree in theology if I wanted to catch up to my peers and have a good foundation. But not everybody should have to do that. And so I am trying to speak to those people who are seeking to further their faith, but are not going to be getting a degree to do that.
And how's it going? I mean, well, first of all, how long have you been doing it? How long have you been on the air with the uncatechized Catholic?
I hit a year in January. I exploded January of last year. And
what kind of response have you gotten?
Fairly positive, and surprisingly not entirely Catholic. Catholics are who I'm speaking to, but I have quite a few regularly discussing with me in my inbox people who are Anglican or who are non-denominational or what have you, who are just discerning Catholicism. And it really surprised me to see the volume of people who are coming in who are not just looking for baby Catholic content, but real meaty stuff, who are not even Catholic themselves.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that that people are getting from your generation of evangelists and apologists and catechists online is that they're not getting in many other places. And I think this is why the Catholic Church is kind of has reason to be grateful to y'all. There's meat there. There's meat on the bone. You take the hard questions. That's a Catholic loves the hard questions.
Exactly. People aren't going to settle for platitudes anymore, and they aren't going to settle for authority either. They need to trust who they're speaking to, and they need the person that they're speaking to give them substance and not, oh, well, that's just not important for your salvation.
Oh, yes, right. That's right. So what kind of issues do you deal with?
I deal with anything and everything. Sometimes I get people who message me who are asking a specific question, so I'll make a post regarding that. Some of my most popular ones are philosophical, and that's sort of the sweet spot that I really try to hit. A lot of my stuff is done in the spirit and under the wisdom of the new evangelization, where I try to not just pull in theology and catechetical content, but balance it out with philosophy so that we can have a more complex three-dimensional experience with our faith and learn not only what we think, but how to think about what we think.
Wow. And so, but how do you decide then? Are you doing these things because someone challenges you, because you're responding to something you saw posted somewhere, or maybe someone reaches out to you with a sincere question? Desiree, why don't you deal with this? Like, how are you coming up with these topics?
It's all the above, and it's also whatever I'm encountering in my life. So for the past year where I've been wrapping up my degree, there have been a lot of times where I'm taking my metaphysics class or my Bible One class or just listening to Bible in a year, and I go, ah, that is a really good thought. And then I'll sort of spin myself up about this thought, and then I go, you know what, I'll write this down, I'll make a post about it, I'll film something really quick, and I'll put it out there.
You have a metaphysics class?
I did. I took metaphysics last semester.
Do not cheat in the metaphysics class. Do not gaze into the soul of the person sitting next to you.
Absolutely not.
That is an old Woody Allen joke. I cheated on my metaphysics exam. I gazed into the soul of the boy sitting next to me. Oh, that's a sorry.
I am way too young for your references, Si.
Yes, you are. But that's part of your value, I have to say, Desiree, is you're not a boring old man quoting Woody Allen from, I think that's a 1960s joke from Woody Allen, really.
Probably.
That is an advantage, don't you think? The fact that that you come from a generation that's actually searching and questioning, and you're there in a relatable way with them.
I hope so. I hope people like it. Sometimes I worry a little bit that I'm too unpolished. You know, you don't want to be overly relatable or overshare, but I think time and again it's proven when I've sort of taken that risk of saying maybe this is not the type of content that I'm used to or that I was, you know, raised on myself, but it just hits people in a really honest space, and I do believe it builds that trust between me and whoever it is that I'm talking to, and I think that's part of why I am as successful with what I do as I am.
You know, I know of a lot of sixth graders, seventh graders, eighth graders who have said, some I've known myself, but some I've just heard about from other people, who have lost their faith at a young age because of what they've engaged with on TikTok or Instagram or any of the online stuff, because they're not ready for some of the challenges. And that's okay. You're supposed to be protected from the challenges at that age. You're supposed to be formed before you get deformed. Do you have young acolytes, young people who are accessing your content?
My demographics are primarily millennials and Gen X, but my third most common are the Gen Alpha that I can only assume are older. You're supposed to be what, like 13 or 14 to have Instagram. So, you know, who knows what age they said they were, but I can tell they're there. I can see them.
Okay. I don't know any of those gen things. So, I know who the baby boomers are. After that, I'm not clear on any of the rest of it, but the Gen Alpha, those are the young teens today.
Right.
And they'll consume your content. They want that.
A little bit. Yeah. So my third place consumers. My number one are those millennials, the babies of Gen X, and then Gen X are the babies of the boomers. So.
Oh. Oh. Yeah. Okay. All right. I got you. It's all starting to come together. So at the break when I got to speak with you a little bit, you were talking about this paper you're working on or you've completed, but I'm interested in it. I hope you'll turn it into an article, maybe for us, about actually, I guess the question is it the question you tackled, is it even possible to do online evangelization?
Essentially, yeah. Is it possible genuinely to evangelize online? And if so, how?
I'm going to say yes. And this is what I think. Yes. And how is complain about the Pope.
100%.
Okay.
It works really well for those rad trad groups, you know?
Oh, you just got mean there, Desiree. All right. So what works? What works on for online evangelization?
So where I looked was actually papal encyclicals. I think that in many ways, they're an untapped resource of wisdom that the laity can be turning to, and I don't think that enough people do. So I looked back to encyclicals, and I started with Vatican II because everything that I do approaches with that spirit of new evangelization. Just seeking to serve Catholics in a missionary sense comes from the new evangelization itself. But as I was reading encyclicals, you will see that they're very referential. They have a lot of footnotes, and every time it referenced a different encyclical, I would print that off and add it to my stack to read.
Oh, great.
I have a stack of encyclicals, honestly, that's almost a foot tall. I'm looking at it right now, that I printed off to read because I can't stare at a screen and read them all the time. But I got all the way back, I think, to 1936, Vigilante Cura is the oldest one that I read. And that one was
Pius
the
11th. Is that
Pius? I think so, yes. Yes, and it was made in response. It didn't say this directly in the encyclical, but you do your research and you know. It was made in response to the scandal in Hollywood, primarily and arguably surrounding Fatty Arbuckle. Are you familiar with that story?
Yeah, he got railroaded.
Yeah. So he was not living a very virtuous life, and it certainly caught up to him, whether or not you know, deservedly is, who knows. But everybody was saying at the time that Hollywood was a cesspool and it was, you know, awful and it was just full of terrible people and you shouldn't even be, you know, involved with it or engaged with it, which is what most people say about the internet now. Mm. And yet now we can also see that movies and radio and television have all been used for good. You see it with everything that's come from those things, touching stories and what have you. And so that is sort of the attitude that I took toward that beginning answer of the question is, well, of course you can, even though there are plenty of people who say, you know, get off the internet, get a dumb phone, things like that.
Yeah.
Until aliens come, I think the internet is sort of the final frontier for evangelization, and getting on it and doing it well and harnessing the power of the internet for good is the best way to do it. And so you see it in Vigilante Cura and in Miranda Porcius, where it says we have an obligation to take these things and to interact with them well and to intentionally not interact with or, you know, watch it when it was discussing the movies, things that are bad for us, and to do what we do in these spheres with top talent. And it talked about the importance of investing in talented people who have the skills and the proper tools necessary to put out really good content, so that we're not putting out stuff that's subpar or like, you know, Trent Horn making videos from his closet or anything like that. You want to invest in like a good studio.
You just said that to make me happy. You just picked on Trent just to make me happy. Stop it, Desiree. Wow. I have to say, I could talk to you for a long, long time, especially because when you go, I have to talk to Joe Heschmeyer. But what a gift you are. It's wonderful to hear that you're employing the gifts God's given you in this way. I hope we'll work together lots here with you here at Catholic Answers. Many blessings and lots of success.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And if I may, I will tell people that you can find me at Uncatechized Catholic on basically every platform. And in a few weeks here, I will be pouring a lot into YouTube. And in just a few months, I'll actually be part of a podcast that is bringing encyclicals to the people. It's going to be called Pope Brain. And I'm doing it with a couple of friends of mine, Marie and Brian, who are also online at Catholic Caritas and Catholicism. We're going to be reading these encyclicals to you and then providing historical context for them, as well as just discussing them and digesting them so that you can become more familiar with Catholic encyclicals.
Desiree Cifuentes, the Uncatechized Catholic, thank you so much. What a great pleasure to get to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Si. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye, Joe.
And thank you for picking on Trent Horn. All right, right back with Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilina with a few words about Pope St. Gregory the Great. After the fall of Rome, Gregory provided a new order for the church and society. He was a thinker, but also a man of action, and his 14-year papacy was a steady storm of decisions, programs, missions, and reforms.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Edgar, you do a nice job of getting guests. I'm so impressed with Desiree. She was very, she's right on it. She's right on point. I hope everybody will go to the Uncatechized Catholic and find out what she's doing. Back with Joe Heschmeyer. I'm going to get right to Susan in Idaho, who has been on the phone, I believe, since 1832. We're glad you're here, Susan. Thank you for waiting.
Am I on now?
You're on now.
You sure are.
Yes.
Okay.
Waited
okay,
right through the Civil War and the First World War and the Second World War, and you're finally here.
You're waiting through size stand-up act.
How did you know my age? How did you know I was that
now
old?
I didn't mean that, Susan. I apologize.
Well, I am old anyway.
I'm so happy to hear you use the word old. So many people
are
like, I'm not old. I'm I don't know, whatever. I'm seasoned. Get over it, you're old.
I'm old.
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, anyway, what I wanted to know is that what leads us into sin is the world and the flesh and the devil. Now,
yes.
God sent the devil into hell way before we had people. And then when we say the St. Michael prayer, how many millions of times has that been said? We ask to let Satan go into hell and all his friends. So why does God let him out? I think the world and the flesh is enough trouble for us.
I mean, I would go for one out of the three zero out of three if we could just settle for that. Now, this is.
Yeah, why does he let him out?
Why?
It's a good question. Like, why is the devil allowed to do what he's allowed to do? There's a few things that we should say at the outset. The Catechism makes clear in paragraph 395 that the devil is not infinite, he has finite power. He is, in the words of the Catechism, only a creature. Powerful from the fact that he's pure spirit, but still a creature. He cannot prevent the building up of God's reign. Although Satan may act in the world out of hatred for God and his kingdom in Christ Jesus, and although his action may cause grave injuries of a spiritual nature and even indirectly of a physical nature to each man and to society, the action is permitted by divine providence, which with strength and gentleness guides human and cosmic history. It is a great mystery that providence should permit diabolical activity, but we know that in everything God works for good with those who love him. So with the church, I want to say, good question. We don't have a full answer to that. Now we can say at a general level. So, okay, let's stop and just get some first principles in place. Remember the book of Job, when Job is suffering and his friends are all telling him why and God's plan, he's suffering. And then it turns out the friends don't know what they're talking about. When we try to explain, like, why God chooses to permit a bad thing to happen, whether it's physical suffering or moral evil or the devil being allowed to do damage to God's creation, the temptation is to give an easy answer. And the divine response is, you don't know what you're talking about. And we get that response in the latter half of the book of Job. So we can say, at a very general level, God permits only what he will draw greater good from. And so we see this in a particular way with the mystery of sin. So, for instance, St. Paul talks about this, how where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. And so, in a sense, we can say, okay, I mean, St. Paul talks about this in Romans 5:20, that God permits sin because more happens through forgiveness, through redemption, through healing. But there's still something mysterious about it. So, for instance, one of the big open questions is, had Satan not tempted Adam and Eve, had Adam and Eve not fallen, would Christ still have come into the world? And we don't know the answer. And you have great saints who come to opposite conclusions with that. Saint Bonaventure thinks he still would have become man. Saint Thomas Aquinas thinks he wouldn't have. We don't know. But if, I mean, one thing we can say is, concretely, God permitting the devil to tempt Adam and Eve to sin. On the negative side, gave us original sin, gave us all the human sin in history and all of this, kind of flowing from it. On the positive side, gives us Jesus on the cross, gives us his perfect human obedience, gives us all the great works that he's ever done, gives us all of the actions of the saints throughout history. And we can say as Christians, we think that the good infinitely outweighs the evil there. That Christ's cross alone is already worth more than the weight of all sin and all history combined. And then you add to that all of the holy deeds every saint has done down through the ages, deeds which maybe wouldn't have happened were it not for the reality of sin, were it not for the reality of demonic influence. And so it's hard to create a sort of hypothetical counterfactual because we don't have the tools to say how things would have looked in some other version of reality, because that other version of reality doesn't exist. But we can say concretely that even though a lot of wickedness happened, even more good came out of it. Does that make sense, Susan?
It does. And can I ask you another question that's unrelated?
Lee, you've waited long enough. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I was going to say, the longer I was holding on, the more questions I kept thinking of. But I'll only ask you one more. Recently, one of the readings, I think it was a gospel reading, Jesus said that he was preparing a place for us in heaven.
I'm so glad you asked about this. This is one of my favorite readings from John 14.
And I'm thinking, every time I hear that, I think, what has he got to prepare? He's not changing the bed. He's not running the vacuum. He's not adding another room on with a hammer and a nail.
How do you know?
It's all there already.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it would take that long to prepare all that, even if he did have to. I mean, besides the fact that he's God, he's also a carpenter. You think the combination of divine omnipotence and carpentry.
You think, but I would think it's already there.
I'm happy to give you the actual answer. So Jewish weddings were in two stages. So you don't have bachelor pads in the first century. And so when young men would get married, they typically would live with their parents before the wedding. And then once they got legally married, they were married in the eyes of God. This was called the Kiddushin. They were consecrated to each other. That's basically what the term means. It comes from the Hebrew word for holy. They then had anywhere from 3 months if their bride was a widow to a year if the bride was still living with her father, in which they would go and prepare a home for their new bride. So we see Mary and Joseph are actually in this stage when the angel Gabriel comes, which is why there's this confusing language where it says Mary and Joseph are betrothed, but betrothal isn't a thing in ancient Judaism, like betrothal in the sense that we talk about it. Which is why Joseph is also described, one verse after saying that it's her betrothed, Matthew calls him her husband, and then talks about him contemplating divorce. And it's like, well, that doesn't sound like any betrothal I've ever heard of. And it's because Jewish marriage looks very different. And so this is the whole reality. One of the reasons we know Mary's a perpetual virgin is she's legally married to her husband and is still a virgin when the angel gets there. And when she sees an angel, and the angel tells her she's going to bear the Messiah, the part she finds most surprising is that she's going to be pregnant as a married woman. And you're like, something is weird about this marriage. So if you understand the two stages, the Kiddushin and the Nisuin, then you understand the church is already, St. Paul describes us as betrothed to Christ in 1 Corinthians, but he also describes us as the bride of Christ in Ephesians 5. And you say, what's going on? Well, again, not betrothal like we mean. The first stage of a wedding. We're already the bride of Christ. Now, what does a bridegroom do when he gets married? He prepares a place for his bride, and the second stage of the wedding is you go to live with the bridegroom forever. So in John 14, Jesus is giving beautiful marital imagery to say, I'm going to prepare a place for you as my bride.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you so much for holding on.
It would be nice if on those Sundays, if the priest, when he's given his homily, would explain that to us.
I wish more priests knew the two stages of a Jewish wedding. For those interested, I actually just did a couple of different YouTube videos on that, on Shameless Popery. I was responding to a guy by the name of Ryan from needgod.net, who denied the perpetual virginity of Mary, but in the process, I gave a much longer explanation of the way Jewish weddings work to explain, because once you see that, then a lot of stuff about Mary and about the church makes so much more sense. And even about, like, can we talk about the church now as the bride of Christ? Yes, we can, but only once we understand weddings in the Jewish sense.
Susan, would you like a book about Jesus or a book about St. Peter?
You know what I would really like? Neither one of those. I'd like the one about Catholic answers. The big book about Catholic answers?
No, I'm not giving you. No, you're not getting anything now, Susan. After that answer, don't. It's not. You're not shopping.
Surprise me.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Another hour and then give it to her.
Multiple choice. Multiple choice questions.
All right, Susan.
Essay questions.
I'll tell you what. Would it be okay with you if I sent you the big book of Catholic answers and the book about Jesus and the book about St. Peter because you waited so long?
Oh my gosh! Yes, definitely, it would be.
All right. That's not an Idaho accent you have. I don't know.
No, I'm originally from Massachusetts.
Oh, really? I'm shocked, Susan. All right, we'll be right back with more Joe Heschmeyer on Catholic Answers Live. Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers. And now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask me anything with Joe Heschmeyer this hour. And up next, we're going to head down to Florida, where I don't know if you know this, but they have an underwater state park in Florida. Josh, watching on YouTube, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Howdy. First of all, I want to say I'm a big fan of Joe Heschmeyer's videos. So I'm a practicing Catholic. For the past 5, maybe 6 years, I've been flirting with the idea of converting to Orthodoxy. I've been even today, I still like go back and forth between going to Catholic Mass and accepting the Eucharist, and going to accepting the sacraments and the Catholic Mass, and then going and just observing an Orthodox liturgy. And I will be going to Orthodox liturgy for Pascha this for Easter, I want to give Catholicism its due. I've been studying a lot, and I honestly, Joe, your videos were very helpful in strengthening my Catholic faith. But the two questions I really have, and these are the two things that I have to give up if I am in order to become an Orthodox, is papal infallibility and the filioque. And I want to focus more on papal infallibility. And the biggest question I have was, I understand from your videos explained infallibility through a biblical and biblical lens, and I that one kind of opened my eyes. But one of the biggest things was it was papal infallibility as it is defined in Vatican I, practiced in the early church before the schism. And my kind of follow up to that is, are the popes above an ecumenical council, and then can they add stuff to the creed?
Great. Good questions there. I think it's maybe important to define a couple things, because when people throw around Vatican I, I don't know what they think Vatican I is saying about the papacy, as opposed to just saying papal infallibility. Because sometimes there's kind of an exaggerated view of the papacy ascribed to Vatican I. So I want to just be clear at the outset. When we're talking about this, Vatican I doesn't say ecumenical councils are redundant or unnecessary, right? It is an ecumenical council. It's not an anti-council refuting itself, something like that. So if somebody understands the Catholic claim of the papacy to mean the Pope settles everything by himself in his own capacity, and so ecumenical councils are redundant, that's not the view of Vatican I, Vatican II, any ecumenical council, any Pope. There is an important role the Pope plays in relation to councils, but we don't think the Pope gets rid of all other forms of authority, whether that be the local authority of the bishop or the authority of ecumenical councils. And so frequently, people asking about this are asking about a view of the papacy that has never been true. And I just want to make that clear at the outset, that what we see when we see papal authority in the early church and today is a more dynamic process where the Pope has legitimate authority, and that legitimate authority is recognized, but it's not the only authority that's around. And I just want to make that very clear, because that is the actual Catholic position, whether we're talking Vatican I, whether we're talking today, whether we're talking the early church. Second, if you want a good book on this, Eric Ibarra's book on the papacy is very good. And I actually have not read, I don't admit, I haven't read Michael Lofton's book, Answering Orthodoxy, but I think we can give you a copy of that. I know he also has done a lot of work in this area. I just know Ibarra has, I think it's chapter 8 of the book, is all about what we find in terms of writings about the papacy in the early church. So when we talk about that, we can see pretty clearly, to give one example, Irenaeus, in about the year 180, in Against Heresies, book 3, chapter 3, talks about the necessity of agreeing with the Church of Rome on account of what he calls its preeminent authority. And so, as a matter of fact, Rome in 180, this is the same document that first tells us Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels, also talks about the authority of the Roman Church. And if that's true, if it is a matter of necessity to agree with the Church of Rome, he doesn't just say, I think the Church of Rome happens to be right on this or that issue. He speaks of it as inheriting authority from Peter and Paul and carrying on this authority in the broader church. Understood that way, that's everything you need to affirm Vatican I. Because you can't simultaneously believe it's a matter of necessity to agree with the Church of Rome in issues of faith and simultaneously hold that the Bishop of Rome is teaching binding error in matters of faith. Like, those two claims can't both be true. So we see, like, the whole principle of papal infallibility, in essence, laid out right there. Now, there's much more that we see kind of as we go along through history. Since you asked about ecumenical councils, one place I would point you that I don't think that there is a good Eastern Orthodox answer to is the so-called Second Council of Ephesus, a.k.a. the Robber Council, in 449. Now, on the surface, it appears to be a valid ecumenical council. It's got delegates mostly from the East, but there's also a papal legate who's there. And it announces heretical stuff in the name of the church. And the reason it's not recognized as an ecumenical council isn't because it didn't have all the trappings of an ecumenical council. It's because the Pope's legate, not even the Pope himself, but literally the guy the Pope sent, says contradictor, like, I contradict, and unilaterally rejects the council, goes back, and the Pope declares it a robber council. And today, this is accepted by both the East and the West, that this is not a valid council. And the only reason to reject it, other than you disagree with his conclusions, but that's circular. If you say councils are binding unless they're wrong, then they're not binding. So it's councils are binding unless the Pope says they're not. So does the Pope have an authority in relation to an ecumenical council? As of 449, East and West both said yes. And you can't explain the seven ecumenical councils if you don't accept that, because the next council, Chalcedon, contradicts the Robert Council and shows the Robert Council to be false. And in the process, there's what's called the Tome of Leo, where the Eastern fathers who are present at the council say that Peter is speaking through Pope Leo. So just as a matter of history, you've got all that. Then the last thing I'd add, there's no question historically that Peter has a special role in relation to the other apostles. There's no question historically that this is carried on by the Bishop of Rome. East and West actually agree on this point. And so if that's something Jesus established, and if he intends that to be part of the DNA of the church, something that's lasting and enduring, well, then we know where to go. Like, we know where to find that. And then actually the very last point, sorry, I said the last point. I don't see a principled basis upon which someone could reject Catholicism and then determine whether they should be Eastern Orthodox or Oriental Orthodox. And if they're going to be Eastern Orthodox, whether they should be Russian or Byzantine or Serbian or fill in the blank. Because on matters of theology, as well as just excommunicating one another, you find some pretty huge divisions. There's a principled reason one should be Catholic. I don't see a principled reason to choose any one of those over any of the other contenders at that point.
Did that help you? What?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. That answers a lot of questions. But one of my biggest questions was the Council of Constance. There was one of the Orthodox priests brought it up, was like Hoc Sancta, that it was the ecumenical council that settled the dispute about the three popes. And that was like the case of like the ecumenical council was above the pope, or above the popes themselves.
This is an open question with the Council of Constance, and this is quickly resolved in the Council of Florence as to whether a council can kind of order around a pope. Now, significantly, the actual pope wasn't deposed by the council. The real pope resigned at the urging of the council to resolve this issue. But the heresy of conciliarism is pretty soundly rejected in the 15th century, which is when this comes up. So there was this question about, you know, could an ecumenical council kind of order around a pope? And the answer is no. I mean, you can have an ecumenical council trying to get a pope to do things, but they can't actually make him do them.
Josh, I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to try to get everybody on here if I can with Joe before we have to go today. Thank you very much, Josh. We would like to send you a copy of Michael Lofton's book, Answering Orthodoxy. You might find it helpful. If you'd like it, just hang on the line and we'll send it off to you. Let's go to Jen in Denver, Colorado, listening on our website, Catholic.com. Jen, welcome. You got a question for Joe?
I sure do. So I'm a Catholic content creator on YouTube.
Oh, cool.
And,
wonderful.
Yeah, it's fun. And I find myself, along with other females, including, I believe, Desiree, having 1 Timothy 2:12 thrown at us, you know, that we as females should not teach and keep silent. So my question for you is, I am wondering what on earth was going on in Ephesus that Paul felt like he had to write this.
Who were these women? Yeah, all right.
All right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, pretty significantly, it's in the context of church governance, not just about women being teachers in any context. I mean, let's make sure that's very clear. Yes, even if you're someone who says, I think all women should be housewives, well, hopefully you think that mothers of children should teach the faith to their children. And so you still think children should be taught by women, whether you think it's school teachers or their mom or whatever. You can't take a literal position that women can't teach. He is talking in what seems to be a particularly disordered context. We don't have a lot of the details when it comes to Ephesus. We have much clearer stuff in terms of the church in Corinth, but because of some of the details that he mentions, it does seem that there are, well, he warns against anger and quarreling, about women being immodestly dressed. So we get maybe some hints at a certain kind of disorder that's going on. But he's not meaning to say, like, women can't be content creators. And he praises women elsewhere, you know, like, for instance, Phoebe in Romans 16:1. And so we know that Paul works with women in spreading the gospel. But he doesn't have a view of women having, like, anything kind of like a priestly authority in a liturgical context. And we would agree with him on both of those scores. Like, yeah, don't decide to go out and become a priestess, but please, by all means, continue to share the faith, because here's the other thing. All of us, whether you're called to an official teaching role or not, all of us are called to share the faith. So somebody telling you not to live out the Great Commission because of your sex is speaking pretty directly against Christ, and I think should be rebuked as such.
What do you think about that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I'm working on a video now, kind of trying to counteract this. So that's extremely helpful. Thank you.
Well, yeah, it's amazing to me. Like, what do these people think about Catherine of Siena or Teresa of Avila or the other women doctors of the church? Like, clearly, these are people that are the church itself says have the authority to teach the church. So,
you know, Catherine of Siena is a great example because she literally writes to the Pope and says, Esto vir, like, be a man.
Yeah.
Because he's like
man
being
up, dude.
Too cowardly to move the papacy back to Rome during the Avignon papacy.
Yeah.
And so she calls him, I mean, it really kind of attacks his masculinity in a certain way and does it very effectively while still being a docile, holy, religious sister and all that. You know, it's not. We don't have to choose either of two sort of caricature positions.
Yeah, yeah. Jen, I'm really glad you called. I'll tell you what, while you're making your contact, your content, and I wish you would maybe contact Edgar here at Catholic Answers and let him know so we can look at some of your materials, but because we'd love to be supportive of you. But we have a book called The Big Book of Catholic Answers, and you might like it just to kind of reflect on and use as a resource as you make your content. If you would like it, hang on the line. Edgar is going to take your call, so give him your email as well as the rest of it, and we'll get in touch with you, Jen. Thanks very much. Got to take a quick break. Right back with more Joe Heschmeyer.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
So I listen to this show as frequently as I possibly can, and I love it.
Just started listening to EWTN a couple months ago, and I pull phrases and words off of the things you say so that I can use them to talk to him. And I wanted to say thank you.
Thank you very much. It really is it's a gift to have this opportunity. And thank you for what you do. I mean, if you two didn't do what you did, then we wouldn't be able to get to express what we do.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm going to go a little quick here, see what we can do for Ben here in Billings, Montana, at the very least. Ben watching on YouTube. We're glad you're here, Ben. You got a question for Joe Heschmeyer?
Yeah. So I know at the end of the Bread of the Life discourse, Jesus pretty famously says that the flesh is of no avail. It's the spirit
yeah.
that gives life. And I know that Joe has often made the point that he's talking about the flesh in the sense of our own human physical intellect. and the Spirit as that's what's revealed by God. Could you share some verses where we could see this in other places, these phrases being used that way?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So in Galatians chapter 5, when St. Paul talks about the works of the flesh, he says the works of the flesh are plain. This is Galatians 5, verse 19. Immorality, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, dissension, party spirit, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and the like. St. Augustine, commenting on this passage, points out the devil is guilty about half that list and doesn't have a body. So if you think flesh there means body, then you've got much closer to the Gnostic understanding than the Christian one. Because the worst sins you commit are not actually the bodily sins. The worst sins you commit, the ones that are demonic, like pride, don't require a body. So there's plenty of times where sarx, flesh, is being used in that context. This is one of the more obvious ones. But if you look at the context of John 6 itself, you realize the absurdity of the idea that the flesh is of no avail means Jesus's flesh is of no avail. So this is what I would say. Jesus has just said in John 6, verse 51, I'm the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this flesh, he will live forever. And the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my teaching. No, he doesn't say that. He says, the bread which I shall give for the life of the world is my flesh. Now, whether you understand that it's the Eucharist or the cross or both, you can't say Jesus's flesh is of no avail because he literally saves the world through his flesh. And then he says in 53, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. That doesn't sound like the flesh is of no avail. Then in 54, he says, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. Then he says, my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed, in 55. And then in 56, he says, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. So Jesus repeatedly talks about how necessary his flesh is for our salvation and our spiritual life, and particularly us eating his flesh. So when he says the flesh is of no avail, he does not mean the flesh of Jesus. He means our fleshly understanding, meaning unaided by the Holy Spirit. That the words he's spoken are spirit and life. So just as Galatians 5 contrasts the works of the flesh with the fruit of the Spirit, and Paul's not saying your body is bad and your soul is good. He's saying you can't live a holy life apart from the Spirit. Like flesh and blood is the way humans are described. So the works of the flesh are human works as opposed to Spirit-led works. Likewise, a human understanding of Jesus's teaching would be cannibalism. And so Augustine in his Tractates on John makes this point, that what it means to say that isn't his flesh is of no avail, but our flesh, unaided by the Spirit, is not going to understand his Eucharistic teaching accurately. The last place I would point you is in 1 Corinthians 15, because there's this popular evangelical understanding that when he says the flesh is of no avail, my words are spirit and life, spirit somehow means metaphorical, and that's just not what spirit means. And so look at 1 Corinthians 15:44, talking about the resurrection, that the body that is laid in the earth is a physical body, but it's raised a spiritual body. If you take that same misunderstanding of flesh and spirit, you'd have to say your literal body is buried, and then you're metaphorically risen from the dead. Well, if we're only metaphorically risen from the dead, if Easter is just a metaphor, we're dead in our sins. And St. Paul says as much in 1 Corinthians 15, that we have to actually believe that this is spiritual. It's also literal. So it's a mistake to think spirit means metaphor, and it's a mistake to think flesh there is referring to the flesh of Christ. Does that help?
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah, you bet. The Eucharist is really Jesus. I'd like to send you that book, Ben. Just hang on, and we'll send you that. We'd love to give it to you. Also, Amanda, I'm not going to be able to get Amanda on, but could you send her the book, The Saints Pray for You, Joe's book, The Saints Pray for You? Because I have a question for Joe that I've been a bit anxious to get to. And I hope you don't mind, Joe, that I have a question, just something I'd like to talk about with you, because there's a lot going on in the United States, a lot of moral challenges coming up here and there. And on Monday, Monday of Easter week, we'll do the flannel panel. We're going to talk about Nicaragua, what's going on down there in Nicaragua, and the assaults on the Catholic Church down there. But I wanted to switch to a different country, El Salvador, where we have the story of the man who was a 29-year-old man, came to the United States illegally when he was 16. The court gave an order, basically a do not remove order. He wasn't granted asylum, but an order was entered not to remove. And he was removed and sent to prison in El Salvador. You're a lawyer and a theologian, I believe you've been to Maryland. So I wanted to ask you, give me a little something on how I should think about this as a case. I'll tell you what, let me just set it five more seconds of setting it up for you, Joe. Here's my concern is that I don't want to be cheerleading for one team or another in political things. I want to know the moral answer. What is, how do we morally think about this?
Yeah, I think there's a couple layers to this. One, when we talk about the conditions in El Salvador in the prison, they're alarming, certainly by American standards, and they probably raise some legitimate moral questions. Now, some of that is offset in the particular Salvadorian context, that they may be the best prison system you can get with the limited resources people have.
Right.
And so there's a difference between intentionally depriving someone and just doing the best you can with limited resources. There's another layer when the United States is paying $7 million to send people to a third world prison on purpose and putting them in conditions that would be completely unacceptable by American standards, and rightly so, because we can actually provide better conditions. That already should shock the conscience. And then you have this case of Abrego Garcia, where he's sent to El Salvador allegedly by an administrative error, despite there being a court order ordering that he couldn't be sent to El Salvador because of fears for his safety. That already is like, okay, someone is being sent overseas with no due process. And due process exists even for the guilty to make sure that they're guilty. If you remember the Would You Give the Devil the Benefit of Law famous scene in Man for All Seasons.
Thomas Moore.
We should care. Yes, Thomas Moore. We should care about following appropriate procedures, even for people we suspect are guilty of things, because the result is horrendous. If you won't do it for the sake of the least of these, if you won't do it for prisoners who we're told by Jesus Christ himself will be judged in part for how we treat prisoners, if you won't do it for their sake and for your own spiritual good, at least have the foresight to say, if, as Catholics, you rally behind the idea we can send people to third world prisons and, you know, just do, even prison is maybe not the right term because there's no due process, just putting them in camps abroad without any respect for the court system, even over and against court orders directly saying you can't do that, don't be shocked if an administration comes in that's hostile to Christians and wants to do the same thing. And even if you're a citizen, how do you prove you're a citizen? Well, through due process. So once you say due process isn't important, you're really opening the door from both a legal and a moral standpoint for a whole cavalcade of evils. And so I think regardless of your opinion about immigration, regardless of your opinion about President Trump or the administration more broadly, Christians should stand shoulder to shoulder and say, hey, this actually is not okay. This isn't something we should just be silent on or blindly accepting of, because this raises some really serious moral questions. And not just raises moral questions, there are what appear to be some pretty grave violations of human dignity and of human rights that are worth decrying in a bipartisan and cross political lines kind of manner.
And you can do that while also admitting, look, things have gotten out of hand with immigration, illegal immigration in the United States. It needs to be dealt with. But when you see a person removed to a quite horrible situation without due process, and that person maybe belongs there. I don't know. But that's what judges are for, and that's what courts are for, and bypassing that. Yeah. And I do feel like also we should, I mean, I don't know if you feel this way. I feel like there were some moral outrages of the Biden administration, and we were not shy about talking about that.
That's right. And I the position of Catholics shouldn't be we just blindly accept what any one group or party does, but
right.
we should be holding up the light of the gospel, and we'll all fall short of that. And so, like, on an issue like immigration, the options aren't just do nothing or do bad things. There are better ways we can talk about this. Again, in light of the gospel and treating people in a way we would want to be treated ourselves.
Our standard is the words of Jesus Christ, nothing else. Well, I shouldn't say nothing else. I mean, he gives us other tools to even to judge his words by, but we can't neglect the words of Jesus Christ in these things. And the big days of Jesus coming up, let's celebrate them, and we'll see you after Easter on Catholic Answers Live.